It's Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and joining me in the studio today, Asheville poet, and maybe what, Los Angeles poet, and
New York poet, Houston poet,
Washington,
D.C.
Right, Landon Godfrey.
Hi.
Miss Landon Godfrey. How are you today?
I'm well,
Landon?
How are you?
I'm doing just hunky-dory, yeah. Enjoying the wonderful hot weather here.
Oh, yeah, it's very humid, right, very stormy.
It is, yes. Yeah, I think we even had an inch of rain this afternoon, which is good for our gardens.
That's right, yes, exactly. Our rock gardens.
Yes. Landon and I are both gardeners, so in our own separate gardens, of course. But yes, if you're a gardener, it's been dry here, extremely dry. They're talking about drought once again. But that drought got at least dampened down a little bit today.
Yeah, and for the past few weeks, we've had a couple of really good rains.
Yeah.
My hostas are happy.
Uh-huh. Good.
My commitment is to hostas. That's, you know, the perennial that loves Western North Carolina,
yeah,
at least the
right.
little Japanese-like mountain that I live on.
Yeah.
They're crazy about it up there.
Yeah, they thrive here. I've got some in my yard as well. Yeah. Well, good. So are you growing vegetables this year?
Sorry?
Are you growing vegetables as well?
You know what? I would love to grow vegetables, but I have a twofold problem. One is that I leave town for June and sometimes part of July.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So
that would wipe that out.
That does wipe that out. And the other thing is that I actually don't have enough sun in any one place in my garden, despite the fact that I actually have a kind of big garden.
Yeah, you're shaded there.
It's all shaded.
Yeah,
so
in the woods.
I don't know. I haven't gotten the garden, you know, the vegetable thing down.
Yeah.
I'm thinking maybe I should put a vegetable garden on my roof.
There you go.
Yeah. How about you? Did you plant vegetables this
year?
I did.
But again, I was gone most of June, so... Yeah. The bunnies got a lot of money.
Yeah, those are some nice, healthy bunnies this
Great
year.
Bunnies. My blackberries came through, though, and I got, probably more than a gallon of blackberries. So
that's brilliant.
That's wonderful. Been enjoying those a lot.
Yeah. And then do you put those up for the rest of the year?
I do. I make blackberry cobblers with them and then make blackberry jam.
Oh, fantastic.
Well,
I like the blackberry jam if you're looking for recipients.
I'll put you on my list. Well, enough about gardening and all that. What have you been doing in terms of poetry? You've got a book coming out.
I have a book coming out.
The pressure's mounting.
I'm very excited about it, but also a little, I don't know, nervous,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
I've been working on suggested edits from the editors and thinking about poems in a different way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was just me and the manuscript for a long time.
Right.
And now it's me and some very good editors.
Astute readers. Yeah.
Karen Andreg and Ruth Foley at Cider Press are really invested in these poems. And I couldn't be more pleased.
Excellent. Editors are good.
They help me make some of my poems better.
Yeah. And, that's always a good thing. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, what is the book title?
The book is called Second Skin Rhinestone Spangled Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I went for long. Yeah, you want to hear it again?
Yeah, let's hear it again. Okay.
Second Skin Rhinestone Spangled Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown.
Alrighty.
So, that's the... title of the book, and it's the first poem in the book.
Uh-huh. And that'll be out in February.
Yes, February.
Excellent.
2011.
Yeah. Well, why don't you lead off by reading us that title poem? How would that be?
Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard that one.
Oh,
if I have,
fantastic.
It perhaps had a different name. Who knows?
Second Skin Rhinestone Spangled Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown. Tonight I will be sewn into it. Tonight, Kenneth will sweep my white blonde bouffant into a side flip. Tonight, I will clutch at my milky mink wrap like a baby kangaroo climbing pouchward. Tonight, I will flirt, but I will not make jokes like, now Napoleon knows what Bonaparte really means, or pun taupe and topos, or try to rhyme them with top hat, because I believe no one can. Tonight, a million flashbulbs will Morse code my one human wish. Tonight, this gown will draw fingertips towards my body like a starving galaxy devouring dark matter. The fingers of the men. The men. Tonight, I will whisper, "Je ne comprends rien, sugar pie." And my left cheek mole will answer, "We're almost there."
Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Is that a recent piece or?
Actually, it's not.
It's been around for a while.
It's one that's been around for a while, mm-hmm. and it's one that actually benefited very early on from editing. It was published at Southeast Review, uh-huh. and they asked me to take out one section that would not have begun with tonight.
Uh-huh.
It would have begun with today.
Uh-huh.
And I really thought that I needed that difference in there. But when they asked me to do it, I really trusted them as well,
yeah.
and saw that they were right, that it really works to have it be this uh-huh. This list of tonight's.
Right. Tonight's. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, excellent, excellent. So let's hear some more of this upcoming
Yes.
Work.
Let's see. Why don't I read something that I never read out loud?
That would be great.
And you'll have to bear with me while I pick a couple of things that it just occurred to me to do that. I'm sorry that I'm, you know, less prepared than I would like to be.
Shame,
I'm not, I know
shame.
I don't have this very buttoned down.
Oh no.
I know. It's almost bad form. Hope you'll forgive me.
You'll get 20 lashes after the show, but otherwise, no hard feelings.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Here's one that I never read out loud. It's very sonic, and it's about Dutch still life.
Dutch still life. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's not particularly narrative.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
This is called Pheasant Banquet Still Life. It says, "Listen. And when I do, I hear the white tablecloth stiffen under the platters." Says, "Listen, and 548 shades of acid green walk in from the garden, shaking dew from their rubber boots, and sit at the table, scraping chairs, praising, praising. Listen, glistens wet, bristles at 45-degree angles, mystifies what is so clear and exact, a list, if nothing else, baked pheasant, partridges, water, quail, Seville oranges, lemons, olives, black sausage, venison poached briefly in stock, artichokes, bisque, shelled walnuts and almonds, turtle and crab fricassees decorated with their shells, cakes, cream, colored sugars, fennel. Listen, waltzes the eye, costumes the ear. I hear the white tablecloth stiffen. I hear coffin. The happy dead and the sad will never finish their gorgeous meal. Says listen, but might as well say hounds under the table, or ghost, or you."
Very nice. Yeah, that is different.
It is.
Yeah.
Right? No narrative.
Yeah.
You're really at a loss to, I think, know exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're hints.
They're hints.
Yes.
They're hints. And I think for me that seems to, well, it does replicate my experience of Dutch still life painting, because uh-huh. in those paintings,
there are hints.
There are lots of yeah. hints, and yeah. they're encoded with imagery that may not have the same meaning for us,
right.
because we don't
sure.
know all of those. We don't all have the same language of visual symbols.
Sure, especially in the post-Christian era.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So for me, those paintings are... they're hardly religious. They're
yeah.
they're very much about the tactile and the body
sure.
and consumption. And I think for them as well, it was
yeah,
definitely about
sure.
consumption.
Sure.
But you know, I'm cool with my consumer status here. So this is for me all about the food.
It was a great menu.
Yeah, that's why I would love to eat this menu.
A banquet.
Exactly.
Yeah, and was there a particular Dutch still life or Dutch not still life, but that inspired this, or did it just sort of emerge?
It was just really the lot of it. Yeah. And I grew up in Washington, D.C., and spend time when I go back home at the National Gallery, and they have a fantastic, beautiful collection.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I do indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So for me, it isn't so much about any one particular painter, although if we were standing there, I think I would choose.
Yeah.
But since I don't have to choose, I'm not going to.
Right.
If I were going to choose one still life painter of all art history, I would choose Chardin.
Really?
But he's French. Yeah. So he doesn't fit into our... and he's a little more, and this is what I like about him, austere than these Dutch chaps, you know?
Yes. Oh. Well, do you have other... Do you work from the visual?
I do work from the visual.
Yeah.
I before I started writing, I was a painter.
Right, and you still are a graphic artist, aren't you?
Occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Occasionally, when I surrender to the I don't know, the muses. So yes, I really experience, I think, the world visually and tactily again. So that stuff is very important to me, that I see it when I write about it. And I hope it's conveyed to other people. I'm not sure it always is, but that's, I guess...
Yeah, well, it's a very visual poetry. Images galore.
Right, yeah.
Rich
yeah.
visually, yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Do you watch television? There's a show on Bravo about a reality show about artists making art. I'm not sure what it's called. Maybe The Next Great Artist. And
no, I don't know that one.
So on the first episode, this woman says, in defense of her work during a critique, I'm not responsible for your experience of my work.
Yeah.
And that's...
which is always...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, right.
That's a fantastic thing to say. And I don't want to work in a vacuum, but...
Yeah.
You know, I can only hope that the poems have some visual resonance outside of my own visual sphere.
Sure, sure. Right. That's an important recognition to have, that you can't control every aspect of somebody's response to your work. I mean, it just doesn't happen. You know?
It doesn't, does it?
No, right. Yeah, as you say, as this woman says, I'm not responsible for your response. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And, you know, thank God for therapy, because I'm sick of being responsible for you guys. Let me off the hook, okay?
Well, how did you, were you always a poet? Did you always work in language as well as in the visual media?
I wasn't always a poet, though I have always admired poetry and been very drawn to it. And my mother says that when I was a very little girl, I loved Marianne Moore and ran around quoting Marianne Moore and probably the more dogmatic stuff and misunderstood stuff. And I had a teacher in school when I was young who identified me to me as a writer. And I'm grateful to her. I wish she weren't dead, because I would tell her how well that sat with me. But so it was a secret for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I was a reader. I've always been a reader.
Always been a reader. So what? How did you make the switch? You know, or insofar as you've switched, I guess you've always done both to some extent. So
yeah, I do feel like I've switched. I sort of feel like I'm a monk in the monastery with the rest of you.
Yeah.
With some, you know, I don't wear the habit all the time. As right. You know, I'm not a nun.
Good.
So I'm a monk. I do get to go out in the world sometimes. I made the switch in a way that I didn't really have that much control over. I was in Los Angeles and I had been acting and painting and really trying to get something going.
Yeah.
And I was asked by a friend of mine to write a television program with him, and I was thrilled to do that. And it was a terrific experience because I was the novice and I didn't really need to show up and know everything.
Right.
And that was, speaking of not being responsible for stuff, that was a big deal for me, even at a young age. So while I was working
Lies
on that...
Lies beyond your years.
Yeah, yeah, or desperate. While I was working on that show with him, I found myself really grateful to have that experience and also secretly longing for some kind of experience that, I can't believe I said the word experience over and over and over today, but some kind of experience, some event in my own work that wasn't about meeting somebody else's expectations, but also that would be bigger than my understanding, because we were working on a show that I understood, and I was I was glad to be able to produce something according to the limits that I had been given. Terrific for a writer.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
To have parameters and to have guidelines. Yeah. Fantastic. And to have a Bible to go by. So we would make stories that would match these long storylines that we had not written ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
So terrific project for any writer, I think.
Sure.
To be under the aegis of someone else's discipline.
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
However, these things started happening when I would sit down to write on my own in the mornings after a long, long walk. And I wasn't sure what I was working on. I had no idea what I was writing. And I can't say that it was particularly good, but it was beyond my ken. And that was what I felt like when I read a poem. And so to write something that I myself didn't understand, I was amazed by it.
Yeah.
I was just amazed. And so that's when it started happening.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody asked me to read a poem, and I don't know how she thought I was a poet, because I never told anybody. I wasn't ashamed of it, but I was scared to share it with everybody and have to defend it, because I couldn't explain it. So I didn't want to have to defend it.
Sure.
And
you didn't have a rhetoric for it at that time.
I didn't. And I could have identified influences, but even that seemed like a big claim to say that I liked a particular poet and was emulating them to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really couldn't. I couldn't fathom making that declaration.
Right.
So this woman asked me to read at a reading, and I took it as a sign, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then through a series of events, I met poet after poet after poet.
Right.
You guys show up when you know when the poet is ready. The poets show up.
That's right. That's right. To play with the old New Age truism, when the student is ready, the
That's
teacher
right.
appears.
That's
yes,
right.
Indeed. Well, we'll be right back.
Thank you.
It's Sunday afternoon, and once again, you're listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio today, world poet, Miss Landon Godfrey. a nice monk. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really
I'm
yummy.
This is one of the discs that Landon brought in today. I always ask my guests to bring in what they're listening to. And so this is the Thelonious Monk Quartet with John Coltrane at Carnegie Hall. Very nice. I haven't heard that one before. So I've heard some other stuff he did with Coltrane, but yeah, always wonderful to hear Monk.
Yeah, he's my guy. Yeah. I know I'd have to share him with the world, but
yeah.
I love him.
You're not alone in your admiration and affection for Monk. Which is a good thing for Monk. I mean, you know, wherever he is. Yeah. It's a shame he didn't get more people enjoying his work when he was alive.
Yes.
You know, he was another guy who kind of came and went. And the people in New York knew him. A lot of the jazz musicians knew him. But, never had any large popular success or any of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah.
Well, maybe he's hanging out with Emily Dickinson and they're just having a good laugh at
right.
the world's absurdity.
Yes, no doubt. Well, let's hear some more poems, Landon. I mean, you've got all kinds of stuff here.
Okay.
Yeah. You're going to read the early one?
Yeah, we're talking about Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, this is where it began for you.
It is. I don't actually... I know I have in my files that very first poem, but I think it will.
It.
I think it will stay in my files.
We're going to bring it back, Landon.
It was very brave. It rhymed and was metered and everything.
Was it a villanelle? Or
oh no! I wasn't. No, just a ballad form.
Okay, all right.
So this is a poem that I wrote in Los Angeles, and it is one of the poems that finds its way into this book that's coming out.
Good.
And it's a very strange thing to see it here holding its own, hopefully, but in the company of these other poems that came much, much later.
Yeah.
I think that that's the interesting thing about the first book for everybody is that
it's
unlikely that all of the poems were written in a short time, especially for the old poets like me.
I think in my book, something of mine went back 30 years or something. It's like, oh God. But that's still kind of cool. I like it. Yeah, okay, it'll go in.
So this is called How to Drink.
How to Drink.
How to Drink.
An important thing to learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Very big topic with me. How to Drink. Put on a blonde wig. Allow the platinum filaments to agree you to cruelties. Ignore the sad moon holes, the tiny blank faces in yesterday's stockings, and remember the first boy who called them stoppings. His fingers, hesitant princes, used to spreading lemon curd on toast, used to wiping hair from his own forehead, used to mother needing her dress zipped up by his shaky fingers. Wear another woman's garments. Hike up the thin skirt. Leave your room. Then touch the first man who buys you a tarot of meager gifts, oranges, instant coffees, a silk monologued hanky, or a plane ticket to the same town somewhere else.
Very nice. That holds up rather well.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Still works.
Yeah,
works. And it's not too far from the spirit of your own current work. I mean,
I think it's true. I think that's why it stayed in there. These are things I'm still thinking about, and I'm still moving to the same town somewhere else every time I move. You wouldn't think that Asheville was like Los Angeles, but it is in some ways. It's all the same town.
Right.
It's all the same town. And these other things in the poem, the idea of things are still a big concern for me.
Right.
I was joking before that I've accepted my consumer status, but I'm not exactly sure that that's true. And I feel pushed and pulled by the things around me, and I'm in love with a lot of things, and I don't know what I'm, you know, what my, what the people who have to deal with my estate will do with them when I'm dead. Poor people.
A great yard sale.
Yeah, a great yard sale. Why did she collect calendar plates from 1965? That's so strange.
It's a mystery. Yes. She was strange, though. So. Oh, well. She was a poet, after all.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh, we'll do some more of this. If you, old, new,
okay.
Borrowed and blue, I mean, whatever.
This is a little bit in the middle. It's neither old nor new, mm-hmm. but it is about Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. All right. How many years were you there?
That's a good question. I was there from 1980, I don't know, nine to, I was there about 8 years.
About 8 years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really liked it there. It's a terrific place. The people are fabulous.
Are they?
Yeah, they're great.
Never spent any time there, but
they're fantastic. Yeah. All my friends were, I don't know, very. They did really interesting things, and I loved spending time with them. That light is really beautiful there. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of Venetian quality to it. So, in my fantasy life, I was in LA, but I was in the real life. But in my fantasy life, I was in Italy the whole time I was in LA.
All right.
So this is called, excuse me, Labor in Vain. Living in Los Angeles, so far away from the ancient city in my ribcage, I am alone. The cacti pluck songs on their lutes. A mezuzah plays harmonica on the door jamb of my one-room cottage. Listen to the sand whispering in your hair, your veins. It tells you to sing praises to blossoming desert trees. It makes you a brief moment in the 5,000-year-old bowl of angels and herbed blood. Bake leavened or unleavened bread. Move to a new house if you like. Time will continue to sift through your consecrated body.
Nice. That seems, that has a little different feel.
It does.
To me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not responsible for my
No, but I'm interested in the difference.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So, let's hear some more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's continue. A lot of these seem to be together because I know that these are Los Angeles poems in a way, and I don't think anybody else reading this book would know that.
Yeah.
I wrote a series of poems based on the drawings and the sculptures and the diaries and the criticism about Eva Hess.
Eva Hess,
who was an artist who died young of a brain tumor and a sculptor in the 60s who really worked with materials in a way that called attention to the body and its almost disgusting qualities, which I find really appealing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why that is, because I also like, I don't know, really nice things as well. But I think that's it. There's something, the poem that I read about this Dutch still life, that surfeit of food is disgusting in a way, isn't it? It's too much. And if you really did eat your fill, you'd have to go to the vomitorium if you wanted to finish. And so there's something about her work that attracts me in some of the same ways that these more classically beautiful things do. Mm-hmm. So I made a series of poems about her work after having seen a show of her work at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by her use of space in ways that were complicated. So these poems sit on the page in complicated ways, and you won't hear that.
Right, sure.
But I might describe this. Maybe I'll just choose one of them and we'll talk about it.
Sure. Oh, I see. I see exactly what you mean. They do sit on the page in complicated ways.
They're strange, right?
They're strange. Yes,
and for me, as an artist and a poet, I sort of reveled in the idea of breaking a lot of rules and doing things that aren't even easy or attractive. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm not sure. Some of these poems I really think look great on the page, and then others just look terrible in a way. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think that they had been designed uh-huh. to attract.
Right.
And, but I'm going to read one that I think is attractive.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. This drawing takes up the entire page and looks like it's almost a grid of yeah. single words.
Or could be interpreted as being in seven columns.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Columns and then columns
grid,
up and down.
A
and
grid.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
It's absolutely.
More like a grid. You could have done this on a spreadsheet.
But if you were trying to figure out how to read it, you might guess initially, oh, it's going to be read down.
Yeah.
And it's going to be it's like stuffed full of Robert Creeley single, short, intense things.
Right.
Disorienting things.
Yeah.
So I do think that these poems are disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I sort of mentioned before is that the poems are found, they contain found language in them, taken from her diaries, and then also criticism about her work, really smart criticism. And she was a fabulous diarist. She kept extensive diaries and started some of her work in them and would keep lists of words. So there's also something about these almost grid-like or list-oriented poems that I think are, at least in my opinion, trying to talk back to her own obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an Eva Hess drawing, and it's called Drawing 4. A vacant, absent feeling, a void to be filled. In either case, it is loneliness and emptiness, which I constantly feel. The intimate gesture. Maybe I'll make it more structured. Maybe I'll leave it changeable. One color dissolves to let the other be. Love invents drawing. It is framing nothing. That which binds very, very finely. Bond, tie, connecting medium. I want to be surprised. I don't want to know the answer. Our struggle is very difficult, but light does beautiful things to it.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Can I steal this for a second?
Sure.
Yeah. Just want to take a look at the grid from which this poem emerged. Yeah. Very interesting.
I hope it sounded slightly disjunctive and grid-like when I read it.
Yeah. No, I think you captured its form well in
Thank
your
you.
Reading.
That's good. Thank you.
Yeah. Intriguing.
It's interesting to work with somebody else's declarations. Certainly criticism, but even more interesting to me is to work with somebody else's emotional declarations.
Mm-hmm.
So Eva Hess is saying things in her diaries that I would never put in a poem if I had to make those same claims and statements in a poem in a million years.
Right.
And yet I feel freed from my own, you know, self-loathing shame about being an emotional human being on the page and letting go of some cool version of myself and really going beyond some social being into that unknown that we're talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
And so these poems were a great gift to me from her.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, why don't you take us to our next break with one more of those.
Okay. One more of these Eva Hess poems?
Yeah, let's do another Eva Hess.
Let me read the first one.
Okay.
It's It's a strange poem.
Strange. Okay. Yeah. Ooh.
Drawing number one. She restricts the palette. Umbers, blacks, grays, pieces in ink and gouache. In one, a circle oscillates between occultation and illumination. Light filtering layers of shadow, even as darkness blots the light. Image beginning, beginning, begins. Rendered in rust, a lime becomes a limb. A conjugation of parts, lines, gestures of materialization. Though bridling at limitations, rules, dicta, monomania of art based on one idea. I love these problems, she writes in her diary. Using black, white, and gray, try to achieve an interlocking of forms.
Nice. Yeah. Gestures of materialization. Yeah. Very nice. Afternoon, which means you're listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and with me in the studio today, Asheville / world poet, Miss Landon Godfrey. Nice work, Landon. How How did you come into poetry? You talked about reading Marianne Moore a little bit early on. You know.
Yeah. I don't know if I even remember that business, but...
Plain American that cats and dogs can read.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, that's a lie.
Right.
Well, I definitely was a reader when I was growing up, and I was asked to read a lot of the things that I think we're all asked to read. Lots of Shakespeare and lots of canonical poetry. And then when I went out to look for poetry on my own, I found myself very interested in people like Robert Haas, Louise Glick.
Right.
Very interested in Paul Celan, and one of the poets whom I just adore is Big Neff Herbert, Polish poet, fabulous writer, amazing writer.
Right.
And for me, reading Polish poetry as an American writer, as much as I hate to make any kind of nationalistic claim, that's really a statement of fact rather than... That's a statement of birthplace rather than a political statement that I'm in control of in this moment today in this studio in West Asheville. He and other Polish poets, I think, allow for the American writer a way to write sentimental language that isn't sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
So the language is full of sentiment.
Or language of sentiment. Yeah,
and it's right. And it's a feeling language. And what Herbert has the extraordinary ability to do is to mix his erudition with his deep feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a political person.
Oh, he was.
Also
right,
by circumstance.
Right.
And kept his poems in a drawer. He wrote for the drawer, as they say, because to publish them under any kind of regime...
Right, would have meant prison.
It would have meant prison, and also, if he'd been able to publish, would have meant a collaboration of a kind that he was not interested in, so that he would be writing on behalf of a regime.
A regime, right.
And that's a story of a lot of Polish poets, but he isn't the only erudite Polish poet, but for me, his sensibility and his taste are where I start to see why my interest in beauty and my interest in disgust feel to me almost like the same thing or two sides of the same coin, because we're talking about the beauties of the body and the creations of the body, and then we're also talking about the decay of the body and the horrible things that we can do to each other. And there's little of his poetry that does not resonate with that for me. So I think I could go on and on to name American influences.
Yeah.
Charles Wright, I love W.S. Merwin, my teachers, Ed Hirsch and Mark Doty.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Adam Zagajewski, another Polish poet, whose work also is based in this beautiful combination of the intellect and the feeling world.
Mm-hmm.
So is Ed Hirsch's work. So is Mark Doty's work.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's what's attractive.
Uh-huh.
I love those kinds of poets.
Yeah. And so... You may have started out writing, you know, ballad stanzas and so on and so on, but formal concerns weren't really a driving force for your imagination, it sounds like. Or was that, would you say that they were?
I would say that they were, but I would also say that I am a creature easily embarrassed. Much to my chagrin. So... I think that to make formal poems that don't deal with their formalism for me is difficult.
Uh-huh.
I can't do it. If I have a poem, if I write a poem that is purely straight on, write up rhymes and unvarying metrics, then that that poem has to have a big sense of humor. It has to be funny, uh-huh. or I feel strange. I feel like I'm playing dress up. But I will tell you that I'm extremely concerned about form and metrical questions and sonics. And I hide a lot of that stuff in poems. And I also am very interested in borrowed forms. For instance, those Ava Hess poems borrow visual forms that allow me to create formal structures that then make me make choices. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in how poets make choices. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested, you know, I disagree with Frost that free verse is playing tennis without a net.
Oh, yeah, well.
Right? And I really admire his very dark and disturbing work. Mm-hmm. And I'm less interested, much less interested, in the New England, yeah. Maine, Vermont, folksy apple cider guy.
Right.
Not
right.
my deal
yeah, right.
at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But really interesting argument about mm-hmm. the tennis and the...
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, right. super interesting. So, sorry, this is sort of a long answer to
That's
your question,
right. yeah.
but... But so I'm interested in it, and I think it's there if you're looking for it. But I also think that these are contemporary poems, mm-hmm. and because, for instance, I'm reading Herbert in translation, I'm not necessarily privy to some of his formal tricks.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Although his translators, among them Alyssa Vallis and Claire Kavanaugh, are very deft mm-hmm. translators.
Yeah.
Claire translates Adam Zagajewski. I don't know if she ever does. Has it done any Herbert?
Yeah.
But I think that my interest is also in creating work that is, you know, has a gestalt that's larger than its parts.
Yeah. Yeah. Good, good, good. Yeah, I think Frost, for him, the nets were invisible, but we still work with nets.
Yeah, and I, exactly. Yeah. So I'm wondering where those nets are.
Yeah.
I'm really wondering. There's a, you know that book about how to end poems, poetic closure, I think it's called, by Barbara Herzstein Smith. It's a terrific book.
It's a very sophisticated,
very smart analysis of different ways that poems end.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it as a kind of workbook. And here are the ways. Now, it's not written like that. It's it's very dense, and you really have to read it and then make your own notes from it. There are no charts in it. If you want this ending, you must do these things. But when she talks about formal decisions that we make, that's very interesting to me as somebody who usually writes what we would call free verse.
Mm-hmm.
So if I, in the end of a poem, refer back to the beginning, either mm-hmm. by repeating a line, that may be the most simple way to end a poem.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll know, as the listener, that the poem's over.
Right.
Now, you'll also know because I'll stop talking.
Right. Dead giveaway.
And start weeping. Right. Dead giveaway. But so I'm very interested in those ways that the poem will begin to accelerate towards an ending, how the poem decides to end, how I decide to work with the poem to create an ending, I think is the way to talk about formal considerations that's the most accurate and meaningful for me. So I don't know how to answer that question. Yes, formal considerations have always been a concern, but I am interested in the observed world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure, including the form observed in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, that's nicely put.
Yeah, interesting. Well, let's hear some more poems.
Well, we're talking about reading, and we're talking about who we're reading. So why don't I read a poem that's in this book, and then a poem that is not in this book that were written during the same rereading festival of Zbigniew Herbert. So this is one of my practices, is to read a lot of a poet's work straight through.
Yeah.
I also like to do it with fiction writers. And although I don't write fiction, I really, you know, once I love somebody, I can't stop.
Yeah, I go through the whole corpus of their work if I can.
That's
if I
right.
can get it.
Exactly.
Know, right. Yeah.
So these poems were written having read over and over and over again Herbert's prose poems. And that's a whole show. But yeah. he really is one of the masters of the prose poem.
Okay.
And yeah. I don't know how to even explain the prose poem.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right.
So here's one that's from the book. It's called Lamp.
Okay.
The very small lamp sits on a very small shelf built into a corner above a bed. The lamp's dark green shade and dark hammered metal jar dress the lamp's main event, a squat stem yellowed and wax dripped in imitation of a candle. It is plastic. The lamp feels ashamed of how proud it is to look down on the recently disheveled bed.
Nice.
And this poem is not in the book.
Okay.
And I don't know whether it is. I don't know if this poem is finished or not. I don't know.
I don't know. Do your poems tend to, like, morph? How do you know when one's finished?
I know when one is finished when I get that kind of full and hollow feeling all at the same time. I don't know how to explain that better. Yeah. But, you know, the poem often tells me when it's finished. And that sometimes is after many, many, many revisions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's there. I'm not a prolific writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a system for ending a poem. Not that prolific writers have a system, but, you know, I worry it a lot.
Yeah. Prolific writers don't have time to worry them.
Yeah, that's right.
Too busy.
That's right. They're on to the next poem.
All right.
I don't know. It's enviable in a way.
It is.
If you're looking for a big body of work. And,
right.
I, you know, I don't know where my next book is going to come from because I don't know if I've written it yet.
Yeah. Well, let's hear this. Let's see if this is part of
it. Okay. This is called Inherited Ink Well. When the antique sterling inkwell arrives from its dead owner's estate, I'm reading this from my notebook. So hold on a second. I think I need to start again because I have a bunch of things circled and a bunch of arrows.
Typical notebook poem.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Okay, so now right. I see what I'm after here.
Okay.
Inherited inkwell. When the antique sterling inkwell arrives after making the journey from its dead owner's estate, the other objects in the new house observe it with cool eyes. Clearly they think those curves and filigrees bespeak an affection for philosophy or power. Therefore they shun the inkwell, keeping their own straight lines and unadorned exteriors to themselves. What they never guess, the lonely inkwell is illiterate. Only the pens can read.
Nice. I think that'll make the next one.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell anybody who wants to fight with me about that. I feel a lot for those objects and how unhappy they make each other. They're so mean.
The sorrow of objects.
They're so mean.
Well, Landon, give us one more.
Okay. I'm very interested in other poets' assignments to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So Merwin, a few books ago, assigned himself a series of odes. He wrote odes to things. Right. And I read that book and loved it. I really do love his work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a surprise that I loved it. Mm-hmm. But I loved the assignment and gave it to myself.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So this is called, it's to a color. It's written to a color.
Uh-huh.
The color citrine.
Citrine. Okay.
Which is, a kind of green color.
Greenish. Yeah.
So this is called To Citrine. You flash bright green, bright shine, so even lying on the sidewalk next to a marble pillar, you seem alive. Before I can pick you up, a little boy lifts your body. His mother hums, hummingbird. He hums, hummingbird, back into the mirror of her voice, the sad sound reflecting off their tongues and off your jewel belly, which nudges the sun like a hill in a miniature landscape painting, echoing, diminishing song, and off the tearless joy of eyes hearing your green fire.
Very nice, very nice. Lyndon, tell us once again the title of this book that's coming out in February, and it's coming out from...
Cider Press.
Cider Press, okay. And it is?
It's called Second Skin, Rhinestone Spangled, Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown.
Something to keep an eye peeled for, indeed. Wordplay for this week. Join us again next week for more poetry on the airwaves. Thanks for tuning in. For more information about today's program, you can try naturespoetry.blogspot.com, and occasionally there will be more goodies. And as always, there's the catalog there of Wordplay shows.